Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today was supposed to be Vince Masson. Unfortunately, he had a last-minute emergency that prevented him from joining us this week, so I am flying solo, which happens every now and again, but that's okay. We will persevere and carry on as if Vince were here, and we wish he was here, and we wish him well until we can hopefully have him back on again soon. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new crime thriller heist drama Widows. That will be in the second half of the show. And also in the second half of the show, we're going to replay a bit of the interview I did back in September with Adam Naiman, who wrote the book The Coen Brothers. This book really ties the films together, and it is about the work of the Coen Brothers. They of Blood Simple, Fargo, Hail Caesar, The Big Lebowski, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, all those great movies, and it might make a great Christmas gift, especially if you have someone on your list who might have seen The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which was just released on Netflix and is available for you to watch anytime on there. Before we get to all that, though, in the first half of the show, I'm going to play another bit of an interview I did just a few weeks ago, actually, with Astra Taylor. She is a documentary filmmaker who made the new film What is Democracy? And it played at the Guelph Film Festival earlier this month. But it's a very important film, very interesting film, too, in terms of challenging where you think or what you think democracy is, and what you think the challenges to democracy presently are. It's from the National Film Board, so it will be available pretty easily at some point. I'm not sure when exactly that announcement has been made, but it would be a film to keep your eye open for, especially if you like documentaries, especially if you like political documentaries. And yeah, that's all I will say about that. To cue us up, though, I am going to talk a bit about the passing last week of Stan Lee. Stan Lee, of course, is the man who co-created almost all of the Marvel Universe as we know it, at least when we were talking about between the years 1961 and, you know, 1970-something, when he sort of took a more managerial role of Marvel Comics as the editor-in-chief and the publisher. But, you know, when you're talking about heroes, superheroes like the Fantastic Four, X-Men, the Avengers, Thor, Doctor Strange, Black Panther, Namor the Submariner, Iron Man, the Hulk, on and on and on, that is partial credit to Stan Lee. And he was 95 years old when he passed. Unfortunately, his wife died last year. And they were married for like 69 years. And it's one of those funny things in life when you have a couple that was married that long. It's unfortunate that when one of them passes, the other one is sort of not long. I remember this because I had neighbors who were married for about that long. And she passed away one year and he passed away the next. It just seems to be the way of things. To Stan Lee's legacy, I mean, there's been this incredible outpouring of affection and esteem for what he did. The only kind of outlier was Bill Maher got into a bit of trouble for suggesting that, you know, much of the strongman, the belief in the strongman who can do anything, that is sort of galvanized people who support Donald Trump, that could sort of be traced back to Stan Lee in some way, who, you know, helped birth the modern notions of superheroes. I think that's a bit of a stretch, but I did want to focus, and I wish Vince was here to sort of talk about it, because Vince is our superhero skeptic on the panel in terms of, you know, these big blockbusters that have become so important in the media diet. He is not a big fan of some of these blockbusters, which of course is, you know, can be traced back to Stan Lee. I was thinking a lot this week about Stan Lee and the relationships he had with the other people who co-created the Marvel Universe, primarily Jack Kirby, who drew the Fantastic Four and the Avengers. I'm reasonably sure he also drew the X-Men initially. Captain America 2 he co-created back in 1941 when Stan Lee was, you know, basically the coffee boy at what was Timely Comics, what would become Marvel Comics a couple of decades later, but what at the time was Timely Comics, which was like this kind of low-end piece of this publishing empire. It was, you know, comics sort of helped pay the bills, but, you know, it wasn't where the money was in publishing. It, you know, it was in the books and the periodicals and things. Comic books, of course, this is kind of getting off track, but comic books, pre-World War One, the reason why there are so few of them is because a lot of them are just like scooped up and recycled. And when World War II came along, things like paper were commodities necessary to help the war effort. So comic books were just scooped up and recycled, which gives you some idea of just, you know, how imprecious they were and how Stan Lee helped to change that. But the relationship with Jack Kirby is interesting because Stan Lee gets the lion's share of the credit, where somebody like Jack Kirby has sort of had to fight for his fair share, even though there's reasonable evidence to say that Jack Kirby may have been the real creative inspiration behind. Not to diminish Stan Lee. I read one quote that said, you know, Stan Lee gave the Marvel characters their humanity. Jack Kirby gave them their divinity, which I thought was kind of an elegant way to put it. But I was sort of reading some of the back history of the Lee-Kirby relationship, and it points out that while Stan Lee was working at Marvel in the 50s, comic book industry was struggling, but over at DC, Jack Kirby was busy creating characters who, you know, still resonate today, like Sandman. Not the Neil Gaiman version of Sandman, for you comic nerds out there, but the Golden Age superhero Sandman. Manhunter is another one that Jack Kirby created. He was very busy and very successful. And then after, when he parted ways with Marvel, after he fell out with Stan Lee in the 60s, he goes back to DC and he makes the New Gods and Darkseid and a lot of the mythology that the Justice League movie that came out last year was based on, the Mother Boxes and that sort of thing. That's Jack Kirby, too. It makes you wonder who was the real sort of genius in that scenario. Maybe they were both equally geniuses, but certainly Stan Lee is able to, or was able to, I guess, you know, take his share and run with it. You know, he was the face. He's, you know, I think there's only two or three Marvel movies he hasn't cameoed in. Steve Ditko, too, who co-created Spider-Man and Doctor Strange with Stan Lee. Although Peter Parker's a great character, I wonder how much of that is just the great costume design of Spider-Man. That is one of the iconic comic book costumes of all time. And that's Steve Ditko, who's, you know, I don't know how much, you know, conventions and things he does. I don't think he does any, but, you know, he's lived in this relative obscurity. And yeah, his name appears on the credits. When you watch a Spider-Man movie, it says Spider-Man created by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. But, you know, I don't think Steve Ditko is a name that a lot of people know. And that's a shame. Because, you know, he did create that costume that's, you know, the world over and translatable in so many ways. You know, the Spider-Man pajamas, Spider-Man hoodies and T-shirts. It's, you know, and no matter how many times they try and change Spider-Man's costume, and they do, you know, the black costume, there's the Scarlet Spider costume, the Iron Spider costume, but it keeps going back to that good old red and white. And, did I say red and white? Red and blue. The Spider-Man red and blue. Although he's probably had a red and white costume at some point. And I think there's like I've seen somebody at cons in like a Canadian version of the Spider-Man costume. Yeah, so I just want to sort of temper the adulation for Stan Lee to a degree. And if you're terribly interested, You can find my YouTube page, which is youtube.com/iconoplat, iconoplat. I took a cell phone video of Stanley at Fan Expo. I think it was 2016. And that was kind of billed as his last Fan Expo appearance. And the last about 5 or 6 minutes of his Q&A is on there, and you can watch it if you want. I saw Stanley at Fan Expo a couple of times, and you know, he was always, you know, really great with the fans, despite his age, and you know, despite, you know, having some hearing problems. The last one, he had like an assistant there with him to sort of repeat the question, and I think that's a great legacy to leave on too. Is I think he had a tremendous appreciation for his fans. He had some rough collaborations with his partners at the office, but he always made time for his fans, which I think he will be well remembered for, and fondly. So rest in peace, Stanley, wherever you are. I'll leave that there, and I'm going to throw it to an interview I did a couple of weeks back with Astra Taylor, she who directed What is Democracy? This isn't the whole interview. You can listen to that if you just scroll down on the Guelph Politicast channel on your iTunes or Spotify or Google Play or Stitcher. And you can find that episode and you can listen to the whole interview. I hope this gives you a nice taste of the conversation, though. And no spoilers for What is Democracy, which is a really great documentary and you should find as soon as it comes available. And it'll be available through the NFB, for, so it'll be very easy to access. Anyway, so here is Astra Taylor of What is Democracy. I guess we'll start with the most obvious question, which is, how do you tackle a project like this? Did it start with the idea? And I gathered from watching the film, it didn't start with the idea of doing a documentary about what is democracy and what democracy is. But how did this project evolve into what it became?
Well, there are multiple sort of strands combined, encouraging me to take on this rather unwieldy project, right? A film about democracy. The first was, you know, I made two philosophy films. I made a film in quite a while, almost 10 years. And it was always in the back of my head that, you know, I needed to make it a philosophy trilogy. I had to make a third nerd movie.
People have to know how it ended.
Yeah, people have to know how it ends, exactly. And, you know, I wanted it to be more digressive and more sort of personal than the other films were in some ways. So I had this sort of feeling of the kind of film I wanted to make. So I love films like Chronicle of a Summer or Le Jolly May, you know, the Chris Marker film, mm-hmm. That are these sort of, you know, cinema verite in the classic sense, right, of the sort of cinema of truth, where they're just sort of simple films that are people talking and kind of getting to the sort of substance, real substance and issues, right? But they're not sort of typical, you know, political films that explore an issue in a sort of didactic way, and they're not like biopics or narratives.
Right.
They're these sort of, you know, expansive, digressive, and yet very humble films at the same time. So I kind of wanted to make a film in that vein. I had also been doing a lot of political work and organizing, you know, and this word that kept coming up was democracy. You know, I just felt that we meaning activists, didn't actually have a lot of tools at our disposal. We knew what we were against. We knew that the political system we were fighting was corrupt and letting us down, and, you know, our representatives didn't really represent us.
Right.
But then I felt like our sort of conceptual toolkit was limited. And, you know, what is democracy, actually? You know, as someone says in the film, we know what they claim for it to be.
Right.
But that's not what it could be. That's not what it is. And, you know, even when I embarked on the film, I sort of wondered, should we abandon the term for something else? You know, has this word just been too hollowed out and corrupted? So, you know, and at some point I just sort of thought, okay, this is actually making a movie about the topic would give me an excuse to step back and reflect and approach these issues from a new angle, and maybe to help other people, you know, do the same.
Yeah, and it's what's interesting about the film is that I'm not sure the question is so much answered as a lot of different questions are posed. That one of the things that struck me was there's a couple of scenes right after each other where you're talking to this one girl in North Carolina who's talking about what democracy is, and to her that's the American dream. And then there's a young woman you were talking to before that who was talking about, you know, for me, democracy is this struggle. Freedom is this struggle. I can go to school and go into debt. I could be arrested by the police for having a small amount of pot in my car. And, you know, that's democracy to me. And I think the film is filled with these sort of, I guess, battling beliefs in terms of what democracy is. You know, on the one hand, you have someone talking about limited freedom. On the other hand, you're talking about someone who's talking about the base commerce of the country.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the film, you know, for me, the film has to have that, that those contradictions and that sort of polyphonic plurality of voices, because it has to be democratic in the form, and in its content. And so, you know, you hit it exactly right. The film doesn't answer the question, and so I hope the title is received in a philosophical. It's a philosophical gesture.
Right.
You know, a philosophical orientation is to take anything and turn it into a question. So, you know, this word we hear all the time, what is it? I mean, this is such a contested term. It means the demos, you know, have the power, kratia. But what does it mean? Who are the people and how do they exercise this power? You know, what values guide us? How do we establish the boundaries of our communities? There's so many questions that are just inherent in the term. And so the film is, you know, and it's partly because I do a lot of organizing work. So I know what it's like to be out there trying to persuade people to take action and telling people, you know, what the solution is. But with the film, I wanted to operate in a philosophical mode and say, you know, let's challenge our own assumptions. Let's hear from someone else and maybe they'll take things in a direction we didn't expect. You know, let's really, just try to question what we think we know, and that's sort of the Socratic mode, right? So the film features Plato's Republic, you know, in part because I wanted to remind us that these aren't new struggles. A lot of the issues we're facing, you know, like the divide between the rich and the poor and questions of demagogues and stuff, these are challenges that go back millennia. But, you know, Plato's most famous character was Socrates, who went around asking the people of Athens, you know, what is justice? What is justice? What is the good life, and you know, how do we achieve it? And he was famous for just kind of being a gadfly and provoking people. And so, you know, I think there's a Socratic spirit. You know, there's this Socratic element to the film, and it's kind of like, well, what would Socrates look like in 2018? Maybe he wouldn't be an old man. Maybe he'd be me. You know,
right?
A woman walking around the streets, talking to kids, talking to refugees, talking to doctors. I always want to take these ideas that can be pretty rarefied and bring them out. I mean, this is what all my films do, is like bring them out into the street and approach them with both reverence and irreverence. Like, I love philosophy, I love theory, but, you know, it's not something that just belongs in some dusty old archive.
No, and it casts into stark relief because you talk to some people who are probably more privileged, you know, people who live in North America, and they talk about democracy as freedom. But you're also talking to the young woman who escaped Aleppo, and she says, to me, democracy is justice. And I think that was something touched upon by the people who were working in the co-op, too, that to them, democracy is justice, too. And what the film, I think, makes a compelling point is that freedom and justice, while being democratic values, are not necessarily in sync with each other in our democracy. Because Cornel West makes the point that the Emancipation Proclamation was a dictatorial action.
Yeah,
that gave freedom to a lot of people when Abraham Lincoln signed it, but it was by no means a democratic action. Which I just found a fascinating point. It made me think about a lot of things.
I'm glad to hear that. And I think these are all paradoxes at the heart of democracy that we have to face. So I'm writing a companion book to the film now, and the book is structured explicitly around paradoxes, sort of these tensions that are in democracy that we can't really resolve. So freedom and equality, or, you know, the need for structure, but the need also for sort of spontaneity and, you know, these democratic revolts. Mm. You also need laws. You need laws that are just. And the film, you know, I tried not to be too didactic, or there's not a big, you know, arrow that's like flashing like, hey, this contradicts the earlier point, or this adds a new dimension. But you're exactly right that there is this tension through the film, this question about what is freedom,
right?
And can we talk about freedom in a collective sense, you know, and not just as a sort of individual pursuit of, you know, the good life just defined by our economic status. These are really thorny questions, you know, and I think sometimes, you know, we activists like myself, we want to motivate people to join us in our struggle for what we think is right. And we kind of can try to sort of sidestep issues like, okay, well, sometimes, yeah, if we want to change laws, then we are engaging in a kind of act of coercion in service of a democratic aim, right? Because that's why Cornel West's point is so good. I mean, there was definitely grassroots mobilizations for civil rights in the U.S., but then it took the state saying, this is the law of the land, you know? And the paradox, you know, the problem has been, though, those laws can then be repealed. So we're seeing that. I mean, the film hints at this by mentioning the rolling back of voting rights, you know, that were, you know, won in the late 60s. And now the new Supreme Court is going to attack those gains, you know. So there's democracy is a constant struggle. And that's why I think it was important to have this long time horizon in the film.
Right.
You know, it's not and why the film also ends with a shot of myself and Silvio Federici looking at this painting, The Allegory of Good and Bad Government. We're still just talking and debating because, you know, there's no ending. There's no resolution where democracy is concerned.
And once again, that was Astra Taylor, the director of What is Democracy? I'm going to come back in a minute with a review of Widows, a brief review, and then I'm going to throw it to the interview I did earlier this year with Adam Naiman, the author of The Coen Brothers. This book really ties the films together. But the reason I didn't want to skip this week, well, there are many reasons I didn't want to skip this week and put on a rerun. Kids, ask your parents about reruns. Is because we are in the second week of CFRU's Raise Your Voice funding drive. This is an effort on the part of CFRU. We haven't done it in a couple of years, Raise Your Voice, this has been sort of an annual tradition at the station to ask you, the listener, for a couple of bucks to help us fund usually a very specific effort. And this year, the specific effort is to raise $5,000 to continue the work being done by the Mobile Studio. The Mobile Studio is a roving radio station whose aim is to bring the voices of the marginalized to the airwaves. And we've done some interviews with local schools and neighborhood groups, the Brandt kids, Brandt Avenue public school kids. I believe it was them who interviewed MPP Mike Schreiner one day. I think they've also done interviews with Mayor Cam Guthrie, and they have a lot of fun. It's, you know, radio seems like this old-timey thing, but it's still incredibly meaningful and incredibly powerful for people who, you know, don't necessarily have easy access to media, and it's still meaningful. And, you know, this station is filled with volunteers who put in hours of work every week on their shows. They are volunteers, and it's a passion. And I know that's how I feel. I know that's how the other panelists on End Credits feel. And you know, we get to see some good movies and some not so good movies and talk about them. And CFRU gives us a platform to do that, and we appreciate it. And if you appreciate CFRU's work in filling that void in the community, a donation would not be out of order, I think. And you can find out more at cfru.ca/donations. You can give online from your PayPal account or your credit card, or you can just fill out the form and then mail in a check, or just bring cash to the to CFRU on the second floor of the UC, however you like. $25 is sort of the baseline, and we realize, of course, not everybody can give $25. So whatever you can give is, without creating hardship for yourself, is greatly appreciated. But when you give $25, you will be entered into a prize draw for a number of really great prizes, including crony passes for next year's Kazoo, a LP prize pack from Royal Cat Records, a 90-minute ocean float room session at Mondo Yoga. That's like a sensory deprivation tank, if I'm not mistaken, so that sounds kind of cool. Passes for Hillside, the 10C Community Hub, a one-year membership for there, a Guelph Music's Fender Bluetooth speaker. If you're on campus a lot, this might interest you. $25 gift card for hospitality services. You can also use it off campus, so you don't necessarily have to come to the U of G to use that, I guess. And then the other one, another good one, is $50 gift card for the bookshelf, and there are five of those. So if you give $25, you can be entered into a raffle for one of those great prizes. Plus, you get a CFRU merch. I believe mugs, t-shirts, or toques are available. So once again, go to cfru.ca/donate. This is going through or continuing on through Saturday, November 24th, so this coming Saturday. If you can give something, please do. All donations are appreciated and go to help further the very fine work being done here at CFRU. Okay, that's the end of the telethon portion of the show. We'll be back in a sec to talk about Widows. Or should I say, I'll be back in a sec to talk about Widows. In the meantime, you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Our go date is in 3 days, the night of the debate. Now all of our work is worth nothing if we don't move this money and fast. The notebook says $5 million. That's exactly the amount of money Mulligan was accused of taking in commission kickbacks. So over here we have $2 million, 20 Tupperware boxes, each box has $100,000 in $100 bills. It weighs 44 pounds. Now over here we have $2 million. 40 Tupperware boxes. Each box has $50,000 in $50 bills. It weighs 88 pounds.
I feel like I'm in school.
Tell me about it.
We gotta start thinking like professionals. We're in business together. There's not gonna be some cozy reunion. After this job, we're done. We have 3 days to look and move like a team of men. The best thing we have going for us is being who we are.
Why?
Because no one thinks we have the balls to pull this off.
Don't be so sure. Anyway, that was a clip from Widows. It's the new film from Steve McQueen, and it stars Viola Davis, Michelle Rodriguez, Elizabeth Debicki, Colin Farrell, Liam Neeson, Daniel Kaluuya, Brian T. Henry, Cynthia Erivo, and Robert Duvall. You may know Steve McQueen. Not the Steve McQueen, the very famous Hollywood actor who's unfortunately no longer with us, who starred in Bullet and Papillon and The Magnificent Seven. And it's not the other Steve McQueen, who was one of the co-stars of The Vampire Diaries. This is the man who directed Hunger and Shame and 12 Years a Slave. I think 12 Years a Slave was his last movie. I think he was working on an HBO show that never took off, or never got past the pilot stage, which is kind of rare for HBO. But I digress. Mr. McQueen is a very accomplished director. Not exactly known for his sort of more blockbustery things. And I think that's where Widows sort of initially seemed kind of a departure, because it looked very glossy. If you've seen the trailers or the ads, it looks very glossy. It looks very action-oriented. It does not look like a stunningly contemplative view of a lonely man who has sex addiction issues. Why is that so hard to say? Or just like a punishing, sort of grueling view inside the life of a black man who was forced to live as a slave for 12 years near the end of slavery in the American South. These movies are sort of very deliberately paced, which is to say that they're kind of a slow burn. I wondered how that would translate to Widows, which comes from a novel by Gillian Flynn. And Gillian Flynn, if you don't know her name, you certainly know her work in recent years. She wrote the book that Gone Girl was based on, and she wrote the book that the HBO series Sharp Objects was based on. And she wrote Widows as well, and actually co-wrote the screenplay. She's very sort of pulpy, very sort of crime thriller minded. So how is that going to sync up with Steve McQueen, who's very deliberately paced? And it actually turned out pretty well. I liked Widows a lot. I liked the performances a lot. Viola Davis is such a fierce performer in this. And what I found interesting was that the movie never forgets that these four women are not career criminals. And you hear Viola Davis's character, who's sort of the leader, because her husband, all their husbands were killed in a police raid after their last job. They are now, because they owe the criminal, Brian, played by Brian T. Henry, the money, they are now going to do this other job to pay him back. And the film never forgets that this is their first crime. This is to be their first and only crime, actually. And you see that even right up through to the heist. And the heist doesn't actually happen till like the last 20 minutes of the movie. This is a movie that's over 2 hours long. It's all building up to this heist. And there's so many fascinating things going on. You almost forget the fact that this is supposed to be leading to a heist. So I don't want to spoil anything, but the heist scene itself is actually like really well done. It's really propulsive, and the Hans Zimmer music, and this is another side of sort of like Steve McQueen sort of stepping up into this bigger Hollywood realm. He has Hans Zimmer, who's well known for the Batman v Superman score and for scoring Christopher Nolan's films. That he sort of has, sort of the Hollywood composer par excellence, in the form of Hans Zimmer scoring this film. But that heist scene was really great. But all the stuff leading up to the heist is, I think, equally interesting, even though it's not as action-centric. You have this character played by Colin Farrell, who's sort of a second-generation politician. Robert Duvall plays his father. Farrell's running for what we would call a city councilor, and to replace his father. His father is stepping down as city councilor of this ward. It's this ward where there's a lot of changing demographics. And Brian Tyree Henry is playing, although he's playing the gangster, he's trying to go legit. He's also running for city councilor against Farrell, which is one of the reasons why he's so upset that some of his money is stolen, because a lot of that money, though gotten through legal means, he intends to invest in his political career. But there's this great scene, and there are a lot of great car scenes in Widows. But this scene in particular, it's Colin Farrell's at this opening, this event where he's promoting his initiative to get people, women of color, to open their own businesses in this area. It's in this area of Chicago. It takes place in Chicago, but this area of Chicago is understood to be, an area where there are a lot of people living that don't have a lot of means. It seems to be like sort of a split area where you have people on the one end, like Colin Farrell, who kind of live on the outskirts of the ward, who are very well-to-do and live in a fancy house and in a fancy neighborhood. And then you have these more urban areas where it seems like government has sort of abandoned them. And in this one scene, you see Colin Farrell get in the car, and the car drives from one of these underdeveloped areas in his ward, and it's like a 2-3 minute scene, but it drives from there to his more fancier digs at the outskirts of his ward, and it sort of this one shot sort of tells you the very powerful racial and capitalistic dynamics that are running in this area. One of my issues with the Colin Farrell thing is that Colin Farrell, if you don't know, is Irish by birth, so he's doing an American accent. He's doing a very bad American accent here. I don't know if he's like, someone told him that Brooklyn is nowhere near Chicago, so he shouldn't be doing the Brooklyn accent, because I mean, I think that sounds like what he's doing, and it doesn't sound great. And there are times he sort of forgets he's supposed to be talking with an accent too, which is bizarre. Colin Farrell, unfortunately, is kind of the weak link here. Cynthia Erivo, too, who people remember, we talked about when we reviewed Bad Times at the El Royale, she was kind of the standout there. I thought she might end up being a standout here, too, considering you have these two movies back-to-back. You know, she's well-known as being for her theatrical work on Broadway. So she seems to be trying to stake a claim to being a screen actress now. She kind of gets the short shrift. I think it seems to be one of those things where she probably had the character has a bigger part in the book. And because you have the author of the book also as a screenwriter, and they don't want to lose any sort of the details that, you know, the character's name is Belle, is sort of included when they maybe could have rewrote her to bring her in into the fold of the other characters, Viola Davis, Michelle Rodriguez, and Elizabeth Debicki. It was not that Cynthia Erivo did a bad job, but I wish they had tried to make her more of the group, more of a member of the group, I should say. Michelle Rodriguez does a great job, because usually she plays this, like, these tough women roles, like in Fast and the Furious or Battle Los Angeles or Avatar or what have you. To see her play more vulnerable was interesting. I think other than Viola Davis, I think the real standout here is Elizabeth Debicki, who you know, from The Great Gatsby, the Baz Luhrmann version, or Man from U.N.C.L.E., she was the villain in that. She was also had a small part in the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Her character, it's implied, has sort of been abused all her life. Her husband hit her. Her mother hits her. This happens sort of immediately after her husband. Her husband's played by John Berthel, by the way. So it's another feather in his cap of movie tough guys. Yeah. So this woman sort of had been hit by everyone she is supposed to, you know, have in her life that cares about her. And there's a great scene where Viola Davis confronts her about the mission, and Viola Davis slaps her, and she slaps Viola Davis back, and it's this like kind of cathartic moment where they sort of bond over the fact that, you know, they slapped each other, and Viola Davis is sort of slapped out of her mode to get this mission done, and Elizabeth Debicki is sort of slapped out of this feeling that she's been a doormat her whole life. It's interesting to watch Elizabeth Debicki, Debicki's character sort of like take to a fish to water with some of this crime stuff, because she's also put in charge of like of getting firearms, and so she goes into a gun show and poses as this Polish immigrant who's scared of her boyfriend and wants to buy a gun, and plays upon the sympathy there. She's an interesting actress too, because she's so tall. She's over 6 feet tall. So you see her in these crowd scenes and she stands above almost everybody. And so it's, she just, her stature creates for interesting sort of little scenes in terms of the staging. I liked her performance a lot. Brian Tyree Henry is great, but you may know him from Atlanta, but he plays the villain. Daniel Kaluuya, though, is like really scary, though, as his brother. Daniel Kaluuya, you will know from Get Out prominently, also Black Panther. He's working on quite the career. But he plays the brother. He's kind of like the enforcer for Brian Tyree Henry's gangster. And there's just this great scene where he comes in and to find out about, I guess, some missing funds elsewhere in the organization. And the two people he's sort of been torturing have been sort of rapping to themselves, freestyle rapping as they've been in, let's say, custody, as they've been in custody. And so he stops everything. So he wants to hear them rap. He wants to hear what they're doing. And it shows him, like, you know, get, like, looking at them intensely, waiting for them to start rapping. And when they do, he's enjoying it. And it ends with double taps to the head. But it's a great scene. It just shows the complexity of this character who you always see reading, who you always see listening to podcasts or perfecting his Spanish with you know, audio lessons. So it's a deep movie with a lot of deep characters, a lot of complex characters, a lot of stuff going on, a lot of stuff about, you know, the violence going on in Chicago right now, the gentrification of urban areas, the corruption of politics, women doing it for themselves, I guess, a little female empowerment there too. I think it's another notch in Steve McQueen's belt for sure. It's definitely his most Hollywood movie, but I think he stays true to himself, which is the most you can sort of expect in these things. Now, you can tell that there's a lot of money put in this movie. It is there on the screen. It's a big cast, a lot of big names. So, I think this is a worthwhile film. I think you will find it engaging. And I think you'll have a good time at it, because there are actually some genuinely funny bits in the midst of all the mayhem. And a good twist, too. I didn't see the twist coming. I haven't read the book either, but I didn't see the twist coming. There is a twist about, I want to say, halfway through. So enjoy. Go out and enjoy Widows. It's in theaters everywhere. Speaking of everywhere, the current Netflix docket has a new film called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And it is directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, who, as I said at the top, are known for a litany of really great, quirky, independent films. This is their first for Netflix. And although Adam Neiman didn't get a chance to, you know, explore it much for his new book, I think it falls very much in the category of you'll either love it or hate it, as the Coens seem to push one of those buttons, or, you know, it's very rare that they do something very middle of the road in terms of where they get fans of their work. So I interviewed Adam Neiman a couple of months ago about his new book, The Coen Brothers. This book really ties the films together, which is a reference to The Big Lebowski. And you can go back in time on the Politicast channel to listen to this, of course. But, you know, here's a little sample in case you missed it. But I'm curious as to where did this begin? Did you have like an idea of how the Coens' filmography kind of all fits together before writing the book? Or did that work out in the process of writing the book, or was it a bit of column A and column B?
No, it's a good question. I mean, so I work as a film critic and a writer and a teacher and a lecturer, and the Coens are filmmakers that in all of these different capacities, plus just being a film fan of a certain age, They're movies that I was kind of familiar with through all these other streams, right? They're films that I had seen for pleasure when I was a teenager, and then films that I was assigned to write about, and then films that I either chose or was doing curriculums where they fit in to teach about. And I'd always had a mind to write something substantial about them, but I'd always been hesitant because they're not exactly under-discussed as filmmakers, right?
It's one way of putting it.
Well, they've been written about a lot because they command a certain amount of attention and respect, and their movies lend themselves to both kind of admiring description and also attempts at interpretation. So because I'd written a couple of other books on, I would say, only slightly less conspicuous subject. I wrote a book on Paul Verhoeven's film Showgirls a couple of years ago, arguing that it's a pretty good movie and not worthy of the scorn that was heaped on it, and about its changing reputation. And I wrote a book on a British director named Bed Wheatley, who's quite contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really enjoyed writing book-length criticism, so it just came together that the British film magazine Little White Lies, that I write for sometimes, and Abrams, a U.S.-based publisher, had an idea about contracting me to write something, and we all agreed that trying to do something on the Coens that was original and interpretive and analytical, but also very visually pleasing and informative because of all the collaborators we interviewed, that all sort of started to come together.
Mm-hmm. You're correct in saying that, you know, the Coens as filmmakers, a lot is written about them. But at the same time, I've seen lots of different articles about, you know, specific movies. I mean, things, you know, Fargo, Big Lebowski, probably the most written about of the films. But I don't think I've ever seen someone try to take on what is this body of work saying, or what do all these movies sort of taken together as individual components add up to an artistic statement? I mean, from my perspective, and I'm sure from your perspective too, that seems like a big undertaking.
It is, and I mean, there are books that go through their filmography, but this is sort of more contemporary because I have the advantage of being able to write about films like Llewyn Davis and Hail Caesar that haven't been part of a lot of those book-length studies, although I couldn't quite time this to get their new film, Ballad of Buster Scruggs, in it in any meaningful way. It's referred to a few times in a couple of the interviews, but I still haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And as for the size of the undertaking, yeah, and it's not just a big undertaking. In some ways, if you're a responsible critic, and I would hesitate to call myself a scholar, but if you're just a journalist, you have to know that the arguments about the films are out there already. And there's a finite number of ways that some of these films can be interpreted. I mean, unless you're really trying to be provocative or contrarian and you write about Miller's Crossing, you know, you're going to talk about the hats.
Mm.
And the fact is that movie came out in 1990 and there were already some very smart, interested people writing about hats in Miller's Crossing. So my point being that as much as it's an original work, and I think my reads on the films are original and some of the things I see unifying the films together are definitely my thoughts, you have to do your due diligence. You have to go and see what people have said about the hats in Miller's Crossing or the Mike Yanagita digression in Fargo or the use of folk music in O Brother, Where Art Thou. You do that out of respect to all the people who've written about their films, and you also just do it to kind of cover yourself. So the book is a balance between my own original thoughts and also just trying to synthesize a discourse that sort of already exists. But I don't know that anyone would write about their films quite the way that I did, which isn't to say that I'm better or worse or more original, but it's just very much me. And the book definitely sounds like me rereading it. It sounds like basically having me talk at you about the Coen brothers for 300 pages. You know, your mileage on that may vary.
I wanted to ask, who is this book intended for? Is it for, like, the Coen fans? Is it for, like, the moderate fans who may, you know...
If you have $49 Canadian in your bank account, it's intended for you. No, I mean it's intended to be a very accessible, readable, intelligent overview that deep fans of the Coens will probably know some of the background and know some of the contextual stuff, but I also have a lot of first-person interviews with longtime collaborators of theirs, which strike me as somewhat original.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that, and this is something I don't take credit for, I'm as admiring as anybody of, is it's just a very visually beautiful book, and I feel comfortable saying that because I had nothing to do with it, you know? I mean, that's not totally true in that the photos were things that I chose because I thought the screen grabs and the illustrations that we commissioned, they illustrate thematic or conceptual ideas I have about the film. And in order to put the book together, all those images have to have some analysis attached to them, some use, some fair use. But it's a beautiful looking book. And I have a feeling that to some extent, people who just want to get lost inside some of Roger Deakins' frames, who just really love and feel close to certain of the characters, whether it's the dude from The Big Lebowski or Marge from Fargo or Llewyn Davis, the book is big and glossy and, as you say, you know, just substantial in size, and it has an appeal to it that I think's, you know, very tactile and physical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I just hope people also read it.
No, and you're right. There's a very Coen-esque quality to the book design, where it is very beautiful, very well thought out in terms of how it's put together, but it also goes very deep into what the images or what went into making those images and what the images mean. And, you know, Roger Deakins is someone who's become sort of synonymous with a lot of big movies and how they look, like Skyfall or the Blade Runner sequel. But, you know, he's done his fair share in terms of helping the Coens realize their vision.
Well, he has, and one way to divide their filmography, if you wanted to, is pre and post Deakins. You know, he's had a couple of films that he hasn't actually shot, and I find those films interesting. Burn After Reading was shot by Emmanuel Lubezki, who's now won 3 Oscars, you know, because he's Inarritu and Cuarón's cinematographer, and this roving agile camera, which you see a bit of in Burn After Reading, and Llewyn Davis, which I just think is so beautiful, is shot by a French DP named Bruno Delbonnel, who's got a much softer palette. But other than that, since 1990, Deakins has shot all their films. And the range of styles that he's worked in, while remaining distinctively himself in terms of the lenses and the color grading and stuff, it's very analogous to the Coens, who are always themselves, even when there are surface variations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's one of the things, and it's not an original idea about the Coens, I just try and get into it in the book, is are they better described as filmmakers who are consistent in terms of worldview and themes and even the use of actors and certain collaborators, or is it worth pointing out just how astonishingly different each of their movies can feel kind of up top? Or the genres that they work in, or the kinds of characters that they create. I think you can make a case either way.
And once again, that was Adam Naiman, the author of the book, The Coen Brothers. This book really ties the films together. And that's it for our show. don't forget to submit your donation to CFRU to help raise your voice, cfru.ca/donations. And you can listen to this episode of the show or any previous episode of End Credits on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find it on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook or End Credits Radio on Twitter. I'll be back here tomorrow, Thursday, at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And you can find all those past shows anytime also on the Guelph Politicast channel, I should add. I can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.ca for my political stuff. And you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and hopefully I won't be alone to see you then.